Hello and welcome to Real Talk. I'm your host, Susan McCabe, here with you every Tuesday at lunchtime or at your convenience at voiceofvashon.org. You are listening to KVSHLP, Vashon Island, Washington. Real Talk is the show where we seek answers to questions large and small, and we try to find the experts who can answer some of those questions and enlighten us. Today, I am fortunate to have with me Michelle Storms, who is the Executive Director of the Washington State Office of the American Civil Liberties Union, sometimes known as ACLU. Welcome, Michelle.
Thank you, Susan. I'm so glad to be with you on the show.
Yes, and I am delighted that you could take the time to join us. I know that things are pretty busy in your world.
Things are very busy in our world. Our world is always busy, but in the face of COVID-19, things have amped up quite considerably.
So tell us what it is ACLU Washington is focused on now in the face of the pandemic.
Right. Thank you for asking. So, you know, I would say, generally speaking, just like everybody, we want everyone to be safe and sound and healthy and well. And we want any governmental decisions related to keeping people safe to be based on the best knowledge that we have from our public health experts based in science. And the specific role of the ACLU in the face of a health pandemic is ensuring that the government doesn't overreach in the face of a pandemic, ensuring that the role of the government is upholding what public health experts are saying, and that any constraints on our civil rights or civil liberties are completely tied to that public health expertise. So generally speaking, we're just keeping an eye on federal, state, and local governments to make sure that we maintain our civil rights and our civil liberties. And that's the big picture.
So where in our state are the risks most concentrated of violating people's civil rights in the face of the pandemic?
Well, let's look at people who are incarcerated or detained. We've all been told at this point that we need to wash our hands, that we need to stay 6 feet apart, and that's how we can be healthy. In institutions like prisons, jails, and immigration detention, which is functionally a prison, social distancing is not an option. Staying 6 feet away from other people is not an option. And in most of those places, there's no access to hand sanitizer, to regular warm water and soap, to disinfectants, to clean your space, to any kind of personal protective equipment. So a big area of advocacy for us has been with state and local officials to reduce population safely so that people can stay alive.
I saw a heartbreaking video of several women in the Northwest Detention Center in Tacoma who were pleading for help and describing unconscionable conditions, like they don't have access to water. They can't distance themselves. Are you working directly with the Northwest Detention Center or with people associated with that at all?
Oh, absolutely. So the first thing we did pretty quickly after we all became aware that this health situation was going to be very serious was we wrote to Immigration Customs Enforcement, known as ICE. We wrote to the detention center in Tacoma, and we said the people housed there are at risk because of their close contact and their inability to follow public health recommendations. The risk to the people who are held there is also shared by the staff because they are also in close contact with these folks, and then they come into their families, into their communities. So this is really a big problem. It's the people who are held, it's the people who work there, and it then becomes their families and their communities. So the first thing we did was we wrote a letter, and we didn't really get a response of any kind.
No surprise.
And so, Right, okay. So then, along with Northwest Immigrants Rights Project and the National ACLU Prison Project, we sued them. So we are now actually in a lawsuit with them, and we have several plaintiffs who are at particularly high risk because of underlying health conditions and age, et cetera. And we have sued asking that they be released. So the good news is, oh, go ahead.
So these are individuals at the Northwest Detention Center, correct?
Correct.
Okay.
Yes, these are individuals at the Northwest Detention Center. I believe we have 9 named plaintiffs, all of whom, again, have very high-risk situations because of their health or age or both.
Mm-hmm.
The good news is that the detention center has actually voluntarily released 4 of them. That's fantastic.
Yes.
It is. I mean, pleased about that. But those other 5 are still there, and we actually did ask the court to order the detention center to release all 9 of them, and the court declined to make that order, believing what the detention center said, that they were providing space. We don't believe that's true, and the other side has been asked to provide some briefing to specifically detail how they're keeping people safe, so we'll have more to come on that case. But it really, Susan, this just points out we have these institutions and we overcrowd them.
Mm-hmm.
And we overcrowd them oftentimes with people who don't actually have to be there. So what happens when this health pandemic occurs is that we literally are creating like a death trap for people. And it's, you know, just like you said, it was heartbreaking to see those women pleading. It is heartbreaking to think about what those conditions are and the fear that people must be experiencing because they know they aren't safe.
It is heartbreaking. It's horrifying. And as you know, we've all been sort of watching events at the Northwest Detention Center before the pandemic. So it sounds as
right.
though we're piling on civil rights violations because a lot of those folks, as you said, don't belong in there in the first place. And
right.
secondly, isn't there some law that requires that a detention center of that type provide basic hygiene?
Well,
you laugh.
I have a feeling that it ends up coming down to what people determine is basic hygiene.
I see.
I think you're right that there's some obligation that we have a safe condition, but how an institution might define that might look different than how you or I might define it,
mm-hmm.
And that's difficult. If we look at the prison situation, where literally any alcohol-based hand sanitizer is contraband, I guess because of the alcohol in it. So when we, I guess shifting a little bit to the prison and jail mm-hmm. context, when we first wrote to institutions around the state, both to the governor on behalf of Department of Correction and prisons, but then also within counties, the county jails, we said, one, please release people who are at high risk and for whom it is safe to release them. And also, please provide them with soap and water, hand sanitizer, and basically all the things that we've all been told on the outside that we should have
mm-hmm.
To keep ourselves and our loved ones safe. And there's sort of been some mixed response to that. But yeah, that was just sort of the first basic ask. Please, first of all, you must thin this population because the overcrowding is an invitation for the spread of the virus. Beyond that, we also need to make sure that they just have the basic things that they need to stay clean and safe.
What sort of access, if any, does the ACLU or any other oversight organization have to actually get inside the jails, the prisons, and the detention center? Can anybody get in?
That's interesting. Yeah, that's an interesting question. You know, one of our partner organizations, Disability Rights Washington, they have, based on their federal mandate, they have an ability to get in and meet with people in a way that the rest of us don't. Most of us have to have some legal basis to go in and talk with folks. And I can't be more specific than that because I don't actually know all the requirements there. We have people who people who reach out to us from the inside who we're able then to talk with. Some of our folks have worked on various projects with other partners, and so we are in contact with some people on the inside. And so we've just heard how devastating it is right now there and how scary it is.
And are the stories you're getting pretty consistent one to the other?
Absolutely. Lack of hand sanitizer, lack of ability to stay clean, too many people in spaces, no possibility of 6 feet, no possibility of 3 feet, right? So that's what we're dealing with. So let me give you some good news.
Yeah, please.
I know, right, because we need it.
Yeah.
So across the state, the jail population has actually been reduced by more than half since the start of this crisis. And that's really huge. So the jails, as you know, often house people who are waiting for trial.
Mm-hmm.
So they haven't been convicted of anything yet. They often house people who, you know, fail to show up for a court appearance. And so they're being punished for that by being locked up. And there's an awful lot of people who are there for nonviolent offenses or who, again, haven't been convicted of anything. And the leaders in jails in many counties across the state have been really bold and very careful and very thoughtful and have been releasing people into the community. In some cases, they plan to bring them back, and in other cases, not. But this has really radically reduced the overcrowding in jails around the state, which is going to save lives.
That is good news. And do we have any information as to what impact the release of those folks has had on crime rates?
Right. So not fully yet. I mean, we know that the crime hasn't gone up. And, you know, people are staying home.
Even the criminals.
you know, I have to tell you, if I had been in jail awaiting a trial and I was released, I'd be keeping it clean.
Yeah, really good.
But no, so far there hasn't been any indication of that. There was a great article I was reading the other day that said there's so far no indication of that. So, you know, obviously we'll be keeping an eye on it because, of course, if what we learn from this is that people can be released into the community and no harm comes to the community, then it really helps to make the point that we've actually been trying to make long before COVID-19, that we've been locking up people who don't need to be locked up.
Yes.
You know, a lot of people who are in jail because they could not pay their bail. So that means that two people who are charged with the same crime, one who has wealth and means and one who doesn't, the one with wealth and means goes home and the one who doesn't have wealth and means is locked up and is separated from their family, is unable to go to work, loses their job, and, you know, creates a downward spiral, right?
All of which,
you've got a whole lot of folks who are locked up who could easily be in the community anyway, but because of the way our bail system works, they aren't.
So it becomes justice for the rich. And as you said, the individual's situation when they cannot make bail just becomes compounded by the fact that they can't work and
exactly.
can't be with their families. Yeah.
So, like I said, this was our work long before there was a health pandemic, trying to make that point. So one of the things that I am hopeful about, that we're hopeful about, is that we can learn some lessons. I mean, nobody wanted to have a pandemic and the loss of life and the loss of livelihood that is sweeping so many communities right now. But we do have to look for what the lessons are. And I think even some of the jail administrators are asking themselves the same questions. Are there some other ways we can do this? This overcrowding is not safe, it's not healthy, it's not conducive to anything good. And maybe we can do better.
So we may come up with an improved new normal after the pandemic.
Wouldn't that be a good thing?
Oh, wouldn't that be wonderful? Yeah, some positive impact on our criminal justice system. So you have talked about immigration, about the Northwest Detention Center, about jails. What about prisons? I believe Governor Inslee has announced that he's allowing a certain number of prisoners to be released. Do I have that right?
So that is right. And I want to tell you it's not enough. So what we suggested originally, several things. Let's see how many of them I can remember. We said people, obviously, with serious health conditions over the age of, I don't know if we said 60 or 65, people who were already within 6 months of release, et cetera. We just said these are the folks that, for the sake of their safety and our community's safety writ large, are the ones who should be released. And really, for a long time, there wasn't any response from Department of Corrections. I recognize it's a complicated thing to do, but I also know that the longer we wait, the more cases that are going to be. As you know, up at Monroe Correctional Center, first there was a staff member who was found to have COVID-19. Now there are several individuals on the inside who have it, as well as a handful of staff members who have it. And so this is something that can easily spread like wildfire.
Mm-hmm.
So what where I understand it now, that the governor has announced a very, very limited group of folks who can be released. And so that's good. I don't think it's going to be enough to really stem the tide of the spread. And again, not only is it does it turn a prison sentence into a death sentence, it also comes back into our community because of the staff who work in the prisons, coming back into their families and in their grocery stores and all of that. So the results are devastating for all of us.
And we need to be aware of that. I am talking with Michelle Storms, Executive Director of Washington State ACLU. You're listening to Real Talk on Voice of Vashon. I'm Susan McCabe, your host, and we're discussing the role of the ACLU in civil liberties, civil rights during the pandemic. And we've been talking about the governor releasing folks from prisons at a less than desirable rate. And Michelle, I understand there were some strikes at a couple of prisons last week among prisoners. What effect, if any, do we know that those had?
So I'm not really sure. I mean, it had to have had some impact on Department of Corrections. I mean, one of the things that I was a little dismayed about is it was kind of talked about as rioting. And what I really think is that people inside have such anxiety and really terror about this disease, and they know they are not being taken care of, that they are being treated as throwaway. I think, you know, that led to some outcry, which was very quickly managed, as I understand it. It was not long after that, I guess, that the governor announced some releases. I hope that more can happen, so that there can be calm. Let me tell you something else about the prison situation.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, reasonably, visitation has been halted. So families can't come and visit them
right
in the institutions as a safety measure. Unfortunately, and you may know this, that when people want to talk with their families, the costs can be pretty high for phone or even for email. So one of the things that we actually asked is that during this time frame, that that could be waived so that people on the inside wouldn't just be completely abandoned now that they can't actually physically see their family members. I don't know if anything has been done about that, and I apologize for that. I don't think there has been a response to that one of our requests, but that's one of the other things. It is, you know, it's also psychologically devastating.
Yeah.
Just like it's psychologically devastating for us, right? Like, you know, you just sort of hit the point of, I have been in my living room for 6 weeks.
Yeah.
And know, but it's even worse when you're on the inside.
Yeah, it has to be horrifying to be there. And I'm hoping that our empathetic and compassionate governor will see that real clearly and start to take further action in behalf of folks in prison here in Washington State. You said the ACLU Washington is addressing a couple of other areas during the pandemic, and one of those is people experiencing homelessness. What are you able to do for those folks?
Right. So, you know, in general, it's kind of funny. One of the things that we have done a lot of in the past weeks is write a whole lot of letters to a whole lot of people and say, please do this, please do that. And so no different here. We have actually reached out to municipalities to encourage everything from providing public health and housing assistance that helps those without shelter to get housing, to create a possibility for them to practice social distancing, get access to medical care and sanitation supplies. We've asked for measures that will keep people housed, like financial assistance for those in danger of losing their homes, as well as measures that mitigate harm to those living outside, like redirecting efforts to providing outreach services and care rather than displacing folks or putting them in jail, which we're trying to keep less people in jail.
Jeepers, yeah.
We did join with allies in a letter to the governor requesting an extension and expansion of the eviction moratorium to ensure that people don't lose housing and aren't buried in debt once the crisis passes. And, you know, the governor has already done a fair bit on that score, which is really wonderful, that ban on eviction for tenants and so forth. So we've taken those steps. And then also we're just paying attention. We're really being mindful that of what is happening when cities sweep encampments and so forth, and we're just kind of trying to continue to monitor that situation if there's any action that we need to take.
You know, I hear you saying you're writing letters like crazy. What action is that letter writing replacing? In other words, are you hamstrung by the fact that you cannot go to court or meet people face to face? Is that is that inhibiting your impact?
Well, no, I don't actually think so. So the courts are still hearing cases. Many hearings are happening telephonically. And although the court is certainly prioritizing certain things and not operating the same as under normal non-pandemic circumstances, there are court hearings. So the letter writing is really the first step. Like I told you with ICE and the detention center, we started with a letter. Because sometimes a letter gets you where you want to be. The change in the jail population, we wrote letters, we reached out to people, and they've been taking action, right? And then, you know, we wrote the letter to the detention center, and they turned the other way, and now we have a lawsuit. So it's really, you know, the advocacy that we always do, we always start with what can we do that can produce a good outcome with the minimal effort. I mean, litigation is expensive and time-consuming. Mm-hmm. If you can talk with people and achieve what you need and get lasting results, that's great. So that's why there have been so many letters. And some of the letters have turned into lawsuits, and some we're just waiting to see what will occur.
I'm wondering, as you talk about the different agencies and how they've responded, is the Northwest Detention Center a private agency?
Oh, yes, it is. Yeah.
So
in Washington State, that's our only private prison.
And that differs from the county jails you've been working with and the state prisons you've been working with, even
right.
in their response.
True, yeah.
Does this private agency have more legal leverage to be unresponsive?
I don't think more legal leverage. You know, and as I mentioned, obviously we can sue them because we have.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe they feel less beholden. You know, the government feels some obligation to the people,
mm-hmm.
And in a way that perhaps a private company does not.
And I'm wondering, and you may not know the answer to this either, if the people who own the Northwest Detention Center also own other detention centers in the country.
I'm pretty sure that's true. And I apologize that I can't be definitive about it.
No, that's okay. It's not fair. That wasn't a fair question.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that's true.
So I guess I'm formulating a theory, and I have a theory about everything, but my theory is that a private agency that's running detention centers in the U.S. may have some sort of support from elsewhere that makes them a little more resistant to responding to the ACLU or other citizen organizations. Just a theory. In the few minutes that we have left, and I'm shocked that we're running out of time, there are two things I wanted to cover. One is your work with youth and educational equity here in Washington State, and the other is just an overview of ACLU's work nationally. Can we start with the kids?
Absolutely. So as far as the kids go, two different things. One is, of course, there are also kids incarcerated in juvenile detention facilities, and we also have reached out to those facilities to ask for the release of youth for their safety. The other thing, I think, is reaching out to the superintendent of public instruction. So with all the students at home, there's a couple of things, right? We've got all these parents and caregivers homeschooling kids,
mm-hmm.
some of whom, you know, I'm glad it's not me. The kids who are hardest hit by this are going to be kids with disabilities who might have some special needs around their educational program. So, you know, there's a concern for us about equity related to kids who don't have access to the internet or to devices that will help them to do the online learning that some of the school districts are doing. So we have really asked the superintendent of public instruction to ensure that particularly students with disabilities are not denied access. That's some of our advocacy, trying to work with the superintendent and with educators to find ways to ensure that this crisis doesn't mean that kids of means continue along more or less as they otherwise would have, and then everybody else falls radically behind.
Thank you, Michelle Storms, Executive Director of Washington State ACLU, for your time. We have run out of it. Perhaps we can talk again after the pandemic and do a little more coverage of ACLU's work nationally. You've been listening to Real Talk on the Voice of Vashon at 101.9 FM, KVSH LP, Vashon Island, Washington. We are here for you every Tuesday at noon or at your convenience at voiceofvashon.org. Thank you for listening.